One of the joys that can come from being an actor, besides getting to perform on stage and feeling the energy of a live audience, is that of working with other wonderful actors and collaborating on stage, as well as building friendships off stage. Throughout the past 6 seasons, I've had the pleasure of bringing on some of these wonderful castmates and not only share with you their stories, but I get to learn a little more of them than I did before as well. This past year, I was cast in my second production of 42nd Street, this time at the Goodspeed Opera House in Connecticut. You heard from one of my co-stars in that production, Kate Baldwin, last season. And so for this first episode of Season 7, I wanted to bring on another wonderful performer from that production. And when I asked him to introduce himself, he kind of slipped into self-tape mode.
Hi, I'm Blake Stadnick. I'm 5'8", and I'm based in New York City. I'm originally from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I am an actor, singer, dancer, and composer.
Blake is probably most well-known for his role as Jack Damon on NBC's This Is Us. But he's actually been performing since his childhood, and he went on to get his BFA in musical theater from Penn State University. It was actually his mother, though, who introduced him to dancing and performing after he lost the majority of his eyesight due to Stargardt's disease. In our conversation, Blake will talk more about this disease and how it's impacted his life on and off stage. We'll also discuss the responsibilities of being an actor and how Blake has had to remind himself at times why he is a performer. Lastly, he shares the tragic events that led to his father's passing, the impact of that loss, and the ways in which he carries on his father's legacy.
He had certain ideas of respect that he passed on to me, about respecting yourself and respecting others, that I don't know, especially respecting yourself, I don't know if my dad actually carried that himself.
Welcome and thank you for joining me for the premiere episode of Season 7 here on Why I'll Never Make It, or Win Me for short, an award-winning theater podcast hosted by yours truly, Patrick Oliver Jones, an actor and singer for more than 30 years. Every other week, I'll be talking with fellow creatives as they bring us 3 stories from their own life of personal struggles and professional hardships with lessons we can all learn from. Subscribers will get additional audition stories and the final 5 questions, as well as other bonus content. The website is whyillnevermakeit.com, where you can subscribe, donate, and learn more about this podcast. Again, that's whyillnevermakeit.com. Welcome, Mr. Blake. It is so good to see you again. I'm so happy that you're here on the podcast, and you're actually here for the very first episode of the season. So welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Now, you and I met last year doing 42nd Street, just like Kate Baldwin, who was on last season of the podcast.
Yes,
and
yes, yes.
You know, whenever I got the show, I wasn't going in for a dancing role like yours. My audition process was just scenes and songs. But what was your audition process like?
Well, mine was sort of interesting. I had done the tour before in 2015-16. That was choreographed by Randy. And so I already knew him. And my agents got an email saying, you know, we want Blake to come down and like talk with Randy and the team. And this is not an audition. This is just like to get to know everyone. And I'm like, oh, wow, I'm big stuff. I'm going to get to go down there and just like talk and basically get the role. It was definitely an audition. I showed up and Randy was like, do you have your tap shoes? And thank God I did. I just like somehow in the back of my mind, I thought I should bring my tap shoes.
Yeah. And, I mean, good thing you did.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. 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 And he's like, do you mind singing a little bit of Only Have Eyes? And okay. And so I went in the room and the assistant casting director was there, and right before I went into the room with the whole team, and said, do you have a headshot and resume? And I'm like, what? No, I don't have a headshot.
So who exactly told you this is just an interview, a little sit down, no auditioning?
I don't, somehow it must have got misconstrued to my agents, and they're the ones who told me that. I mean, Randy, after the fact, sort of said, like, it was just for everyone to get to know me, because I had done it with him before, and so he knew that he wanted me for the part. But it definitely felt like an audition, because then I danced with everyone after that, too. I learned a combination and danced.
Yeah, that's an audition. That's not just
an audition.
Hey, yeah. Hey, let's get to know you. I mean, I think that's another example of why we should just always be prepared. Of just have our headshot. If we're going somewhere that might be business related, just have your headshot, have your things with you. You never know.
Right. It's like having a business card. Yeah. You should just have it with you. Yeah.
Exactly.
I will say, it did really take the pressure off that you normally feel in an audition. You know, to feel like they've asked me to come here, and like Randy did talk to me. He's like, I really want people to get to know you. But I had to do everything that you normally do in an audition.
Right. The initial pressure may have been off when you went in, but I'm sure it came right back as you started to sing and dance.
Totally.
Yes, of course. Because you do a lot of tap dancing in the show. And now, while you're probably best known, obviously, for playing Jack Damon in the TV show This Is Us, you've been doing theater work for many years. I mean, that's really where you got your start, and specifically tap dancing. And I got to admit, for me as a non-dancer, tap dancing is just, it's awe-inspiring. Like, for me, it's my favorite form of dancing. And I love watching it, listening to it. And I thought you were just great in the show. But what makes your performance, to me at least, even more impressive is that you are legally blind. And so that must be its own process of learning dance when you can't watch and see others to move in that way.
Right. Well, so I actually started tap dancing because I lost my eyesight. I was diagnosed with this disease called Stargardt's disease when I was 6. And my dad had the same thing. It's a genetic disease. And about 9 months later, I was already legally blind. And in that time, I had started before this, I'd started playing like T-ball and youth soccer and all that kind of stuff. And I'm going to be honest, I was the kid in the outfield who like had dropped his glove like 10 feet away and was like making little forts for the ants like out of the grass and stuff like that. So clearly it wasn't my favorite thing in the world. My mom, she knew that I was going to need some sort of extracurricular activity because I was an only child at the time. And from the time I was able to stand up, anytime there was music on, I was dancing around. So she put me in a tap class in like our local sort of country dance studio, and I loved it. And I've always sort of viewed it. I mean, obviously, it's still a visual, especially in 42nd Street, it's still a visual art form, but it does have that added musicality of the rhythm. And so I've always sort of viewed it as music as opposed to just dance. And I think that's why it, not to be punny, clicked with me.
You really tapped into your talents.
Yeah. Please don't turn off the podcast, please. it was that's like what got me into performing. And I started taking voice lessons shortly after that because I'd started running up the water bill too high from singing My Heart Will Go On in the shower. And I did my first musical when I was 9 at the community theater. You know, I definitely caught the bug somewhat at that point, but it wasn't until I went and saw the tour of Phantom of the Opera in Pittsburgh. I remember very, very vividly turning to my mom, and I think it was 10, turning to my mom at intermission and saying, "This is what I want to do." And so being legally blind has definitely presented its challenges. Like, I can't see sheet music to learn my music. I have to learn everything by ear. Choreography is, luckily, since I have been tapping for so long, you can often just say what it's supposed to be. And I can kind of see the general motion of the choreographer, and so I can get it. But I had to ask Sarah and Randy during the rehearsal process, you know, to clarify stuff a lot. And as far as like my position on stage, thank God I can see where other people are.
Yeah, because you can see shapes, colors. It's not like a complete blackness.
Correct. The way that my Stargardt's it presents is a little atypical. So normally there's a very defined center spot that is like void, and then the periphery is relatively unaffected. Mine is sort of like very gradual throughout. So my center vision is definitely worse, but my peripheral vision isn't great either. And I have blind spots, but they're not clearly defined. So my brain sort of like almost like takes after images away. Like it almost takes like pictures and fills in the blank spots. But the weird thing is like there's definitely a delay with it. So just normal going around, I don't notice it at all. But sometimes when I'm walking like really quickly on the sidewalk, a person will appear out of nowhere.
whoa.
And I'm like, all right, there was a blind spot there and my brain couldn't compensate fast enough.
That's so interesting.
I might not be able to tell, you know, when everyone is wearing the same costume, I might not be able to tell you who is who, but I know there's a body there. And so I can sort of judge off of the bodies around me where I'm supposed to be on stage. And I guess an added benefit of playing Billy Lawler is that like wherever I am, it's exactly where I'm supposed to be. You know, it's like if I'm in the wrong spot, I was just like, no, everyone else is wrong. I'm perfect.
So this is coming from a non-dancer, of course, but in the world of tap, there are certain things, you know, the shuffle, the flap, you know, there are certain terms that you have. But at the same time, as you're listening to a sound, I assume there are multiple ways to produce that sound. And so that's the clarification that you need in order to which foot do you...
Was that a shuffle or a flap? That sort of thing.
Right, yeah. Right. And which foot do I use that on and which direction are we going from there?
Right, right.
I gotcha. When I first... I'm not one of those people who like looks up people when I'm about to go into a show. So like I already knew Kate Baldwin and Max. And so whenever you came along, I was like, oh, I saw your eyes. And I was like, okay, he's looking. I was like, he probably has some visual thing. Great. And then that's when people were like, oh yeah, he's legally blind.
Oh man. Thank God for you just understanding that. Cause I'm remembering it right now is like, I was in a cast one time and it was like my first job out of college. It was like a summer stock thing and I don't read sheet music. I can't see sheet music. So whenever we're learning the show, I just learn it by ear with everyone else. And someone said like, have you done the show before? I see you're not using music. And like, no, I'm actually legally blind. So I learn everything by ear. And they were like, no, really? Why? And I'm like, no, I'm legally blind. And like, all right, so you know you're not. And like, yeah. And like, but your eyes are open is what they said.
But your eyes are open. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I don't understand how that applies. And they're like, fine, if you don't want to tell me, then like, whatever. And they stormed off and I had to like go to the back and be like, could you please tell them that I'm actually blind? Thank you.
Oh my gosh.
They thought I was just like being a jerk or something like that. I don't know. It's really weird. Really weird.
Well, this actually leads us right into the first story that you wanted to talk about. And this is how your disability has impacted whether or not you get hired. And there was some regional work that you have done where this has come into play.
Yes. So it was... Before I did the tour of 42nd Street, maybe late 2013, 2014, that sort of time, Les Mis was being done everywhere because I think that was right around when they did the movie. So, you know, everyone was kind of trying to bank on the popularity. And there was a certain production of Les Mis where the theater shall remain nameless. But I'd already worked with the director prior. And so he knew my capabilities and he knew that the ways to adjust things for me. So like, for example, it's really difficult for me to walk directly into side light. which in a tap show like 42nd Street, there's a lot of that because light coming in directly from the wings makes the lines of the body look really great. So that was definitely something that I had to navigate. And I eventually, over the tech process, figured out what I could focus on so it didn't become a complete like blinding wash. But a lot of the times I can't exit directly into side lights. If there's a blackout, usually someone will just like grab my hand and take me off stage because I can't see anything at that point. And there was a certain administrator at this theater that really didn't want to hire me because they were afraid I would be a liability. And just it was just really, I'm really grateful that this director went to bat for me. And they said, you know, if Blake doesn't play Marius, then I'm not going to direct the show.
Oh, wow. He really put it on the line.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And I mean, it went off without a hitch. No one got injured. I didn't get injured. It was fine.
But that also speaks to your ability as well, because Les Mis is not a big dancing show. There's a little bit in there, but Marius is not a dancing role at all. Mm-mm. So the fact that you can put that tap dancing aside, which is one of your specialties, and just do a singing role, I think that speaks to your ability as well.
I actually think of myself much more as a singer than I do a dancer. It's dancing, though I've been doing it for a long time, I think of it as something that's hard. It's hard. You know, I will get it. I will definitely get it. And I will definitely make it look as good as I possibly can, which seems to be passable. But singing, you like give me a song where I got to hit like a high B flat and everything like that. I'm like, yeah, I got this. I can do this. So yeah, it's funny. I do think of myself more of a singer. Just to go back to the hiring situation, a little while after that, I can't even remember what this show was. I think I've blocked it out of my memory, probably. I went in for another audition at a regional theater, and my friend, it was actually my roommate at the time, happened to be the monitor. And so I went in, did my song. I think it went really, really well. So they seemed responsive. And I found out this after the fact because my roommate was the monitor. He went into the room to find out who they wanted to keep for the next round of callbacks. And my headshot was in the no pile. And he asked, he was like, why is he in the no pile? I heard him. He was fantastic. They didn't know that he was my roommate. And they said, well, yeah, I think it was the choreographer said, yeah, he wouldn't look at me. And I do have my one eye especially does sort of drift to the right a bit because the majority of my vision loss is in the center. So my eyes just by themselves to try to get as much light on the living part of my retina will turn and try to get it in at an angle in my pupil. And my roommate said, well, he's legally blind. It says it right on his resume. And I do, under my special skills and my resume, I have legally blind. Because I think it gives me a unique perspective on life. Mm-hmm. The guy said, yeah, that would just weird me out. I mean, the thing is, that's highly, highly illegal. But I couldn't sue this theater for discrimination, even though I technically had a witness. But you don't want to. It's hard in this business, and luckily things are changing for all sorts of minorities or underrepresented demographics. But in this business, it's hard because you are constantly trying to have to get work at new places. That if you get a reputation of being a pot stirrer or someone that causes trouble, it will prevent you from getting work in the future.
Yeah, because they talk. Those artistic directors, choreographers, they all talk.
Right. So it definitely made me upset. It made me really angry and depressed for a few days. And then I had another audition. It was summer stock audition season. So, you know, I just had another audition and it was on to the next. Yeah.
Yeah. How would you compare the limits that others place on you versus those that you recognize within yourself?
You know, other than those two occasions, I can think of one more occasion where it was in a summer stock situation where it was a really fast turnaround. I think it was like one of those ones where you rehearse the show for a week and then you perform for a week. And while you're performing the show, you're rehearsing the next one during the day, that sort of situation. There was a number that included a lot of intricate like hand stuff that I was the only ensemble member not put in that number. And I know it was because they were just thinking this would be too hard to teach him. Granted, they're probably right. They were probably right, but I would like to be the one who would make that decision. Otherwise, other than those, I think three occasions, people have not put a lot of limitations, or they have not expected me to have a lot of limitations. I think because of the audition process, and in a situation where I'm learning tap, I have to learn a combination right then and there. And so I'm there seeing exactly how I would learn choreography in the room during the rehearsal process. So I have to ask more questions in an audition. And when I was first starting out, I was definitely intimidated by that. I didn't want to be you don't want to be the person who makes too much noise, who's a problem. Especially when you're in college, they tell you so much about like, you want to be the easy person that you know, just gets the work done. And, you know, that's what makes you hired. But now I'm like, could you just do that again, please? Can you like, what was that one thing? Like literally, like sometimes in an audition, and I usually tell them now ahead of time, like I'm legally blind, so I'm going to be asking you a lot of questions, but like they can now, thank God, see on my resume that I've done a lot of other shows that require dancing. So literally sometimes it'll be some hand thing. Like, you know, some choreographers do really weird like hand positions. And there have been times I've been like, literally take my hand and put it how you want it to be. Just do it. Just put it how you want it to be. And I'm like, great, I can do that. There we go.
Sometimes I need to do that and I can see what they're doing. And I'm like, I don't get what you're doing at all.
Right. But I think a lot of people in our business, and it's getting even better, are pretty open-minded, at least from the director's and choreographer point of view. If you approach them with confidence and you have the chops in the audition to sort of back it up, I think a lot of people are willing to take a risk.
I was Googling you for this interview just to kind of see what was out there. And a slew of headlines came up, of course, about This Is Us, but with the name Blind Actor from This Is Us.
Yeah.
How do you feel about being so identified with your disability?
I'm of two minds. The predominant mind is that I am 100% okay with it. Because growing up, I didn't really have someone in popular culture or even in theater that had a visual impairment that I could look to as a roadmap of how I might do this. So if I can be that for anyone, any kid growing up anywhere in this country, that's made everything worth it. The slightly negative mind is the only thing I worry about. Is it becoming this thing? It's sort of a stupid term, but inspiration porn, where it's just, look at this guy who can't see doing this thing. Isn't it so inspiring? This is so great. And obviously there's going to be some of that, but any interview that I do for like a local radio station or anything like that, I just want to make sure that we really talk about the show and my process or something like that. And it isn't just about like, he's blind and he does this thing. Isn't that great? And especially if we are going to talk about it, which I always encourage them to ask me questions about it, I want it to come from a point of view of if there's someone out there who's looking for, who is visually impaired or disabled or anything like that, who is looking for someone who has done what they wanted to do, their disability didn't get in their way fully.
Yeah, because I'll admit, even from my viewpoint, I was a little hesitant to ask you to come on the podcast. I mean, my podcast is all about the challenges we face in this business. Yours is rather obvious. It's a little more out front than maybe some others. But I didn't want it to be like, let's bring the blind guy on and talk about him, you know, because I obviously respect you.
I'm glad your hesitation didn't prevent you from asking me, because this is great.
Oh, and so am I, because you're obviously so much more than that. But that is certainly an element of who you are. And it is an important part.
It's an undeniable element. And it has definitely, it is a big part of what informs who I am. So I'm not going to shun it. Like I said, it's on my special skills, because I think it does give me a unique perspective on life. And I think it has, in a silver linings sort of way, it's what got me into this business. And it has made me sort of an optimist, like an undeniable optimist, because like, no matter what happens, I have faced actual hardship just functioning in the world. So anything else that's sort of quote unquote bad that happens, I'm like, yeah, this is small potatoes.
So does your physical issues that you've had to overcome, these medical things, it sounds like it puts maybe anything emotional, relational, other things that may come up in a different perspective?
Totally. Yeah. Whenever I have just like not booked a gig or something like that, I can look around at my apartment and think, I have a really great place to live. I have my wonderful wife and our great dog. I have done good work in the past. And I'm not back where I was trying to figure out how to just function in this business as a visually impaired or legally blind actor.
Now, I want to point out that, because it can be an issue for some people, that I use the term disability because that came from you as we were preparing for this interview. But that term, you know, the language surrounding these type of medical conditions can be a sensitive subject. How do you feel about attention paid to such terminology?
Yes.
As we call
right.
it.
Right. So I call it a disability. And I think the disabled community is totally fine with using that terminology. It is, you can say differently abled. For people who are not disabled, we would say maybe like typically abled is what we might call them. But I use low vision, visually impaired, or legally blind for myself. And I do say that it is a disability. That's never really bothered me.
And as far as coming to terms with it, I assume that took you a while for it not to be an issue.
I don't remember a time where I had a intense or even really a minor negative reaction to the term disability. I think because my eyesight degenerated so young that I just sort of, this is just sort of how I saw the world now. You know, kids adapt really quickly. I do some work with the Blind Children's Center in LA, and these kids are preschool to kindergarten. I mean, they're actually infant to kindergarten. It's usually the parents actually who need the majority of the emotional support and helping them get through this diagnosis for their child, because the parents who are normally fully sighted only know the world from that point of view. So they can't comprehend interacting with the world in a different way. Whereas the children, everything is new for them. So this is just how they see the world now. And that is sort of what happened with me. It wasn't until really I got into college that I started feeling different. Because where I grew up, the kids that I went to high school with, they had known me since my eyesight degenerated, really. So it wasn't anything strange to them. But it went in college, definitely girls were not into it. I was not prime dating material in college. there also might have been a slight bit of desperation that they smelled on me that drove them away. But
I think girls smell a lot of that on men. Yeah, yeah. So you're not alone in that.
Right. But then because I went to a musical theater program, the faculty were great. I mean, they were trying to approach things as well as they could, but they hadn't taught anyone with a disability before. And so they were having to like adjust their curriculum. And the head of the program was like, I'm going to try to find someone who in equity, who is blind that you can talk to. And like, that never happened. So I was really just like walking blindly into it. And that was the early college into the early parts of my career was honestly the most difficult times that I had with my eyesight, with my disability. And then when I started getting traction and getting some directors who I worked with, who like the one with Les Mis, who really could go to bat for me, then I started getting the confidence to say to someone in the room, show me how you want my hand, take my hand. That's when I was like, all right, I got this.
Now we're about to head into Blake's two other stories. And for those of you listening to this free episode, that'll be the end of it for you. But you should know that the conversation doesn't end there. For WinMe subscribers, they not only got this episode last week, but they also get the full conversation with Blake talking about his audition for a new musical written by Hunter Bell and Jeff Bowen, the creators of Title of Show, and his audition for This Is Us.
But I watched the tapes and literally like stormed out of the dance studio on my way to rehearsal being like, you know what? I always get these like opportunities that are like, I get right up to the edge and then I never get it. This tape sucks. I suck. I'm just going to go to rehearsal and do this.
Then we get into the final five questions I ask of every guest, where Blake shares life lessons he's learned and what making it really means to him. This full episode and other bonus content are available to those who become a monthly or yearly subscriber to Why I'll Never Make It. Though I certainly do enjoy producing this podcast, I'm essentially a one-man operation, and it is both costly and time-intensive to put together each episode. So for just a few dollars a month, you'll not only support these podcasting efforts, but you'll also get to hear these extended conversations with guests. So please consider lending your financial support to this podcast with a monthly or yearly subscription by going to whyillnevermakeit.com and click subscribe, or just look for the link in the show notes. Well, I find your second story so very interesting, because you say that you frequently have these existential arguments with yourself as to whether or not you're just being selfish for wanting an acting career. Now, why exactly do you have this internal argument with yourself?
Right. Well, I think being an actor, you definitely want to be a storyteller. You enjoy telling stories. That is a big part of it. But there's also an aspect to it of, hey, hey, look at me. Aren't I so great? You know, a little bit, you know, there's definitely something about the brain of someone who likes to get on stage or in front of a camera, knowing that potentially thousands of people are going to be watching you and being engaged with the story you're telling. So one might see that as being slightly self-centered. So I have definitely had times in my career where this happened actually on the 42nd Street tour quite a bit, because that was sort of the longest contract that I had ever been on with one show. And being on the road, you get in like your little tour bubble with just like the 30 some people that are in your cast and like the, you know, 11 musicians, and you like the smallest things become like really big and important. So there were times where I'm like, what am I contributing to the world. I am not doing anything. There are people out there who are hungry, who are sick. I'm not doing anything to help them. I suck. But on the flip side of that, it's funny, in moments when I have actually been in the height of the beating the crap out of me, there have been moments where I've seen actually what being in this business, doing this career, being an actor can actually do for people who are seeing it. Specifically, when I was in LA with 42nd Street, I was having one of these moments. And after the show, there was a group of people there who were in recovery from an addiction. And they were all there together. They, you know, came up to me afterwards at the stage door and they told me their story. And this was their first like big outing together, having taken the steps into sobriety. And 42nd Street is just such a joyful show. You know, like with what we did at Goodspeed, people just walk out of the show smiling and the kids are like trying to tap dance on the street. It's just a joyful show. And they said they couldn't express what seeing this show meant to them while being on this road through recovery and what joy and hope it gave to them. And I was just like, well, shit. If that wasn't the universe saying something to me in this moment, then I don't know what is.
Yeah. What we do can really make a difference, make an impact in people's life. I mean, the number of times that me being a performer and looking at the audience sometimes, there was for Anne of Green Gables last summer, we had one of these sensory-friendly performances which welcomes kids into the theater, including those who are on the autism spectrum. And just the audience itself.
Oh, that's a good one for it, because that there was the lighting in that was even overwhelming a little bit for me. I mean, it was great, but yeah, that was some intense.
Yeah, the lights are bright, the music's loud, the emotions are, you know, on their sleeve. It's just everything feels. And so,
right.
Yeah, to have that audience in there, to hear them respond to different things, to laugh or to make a gasp or a sound. I mean, they, you know, they were just very free to be very vocal as much as they wanted. That was the whole point of that performance. And just listening to them as we were perform would sometimes make me tear up, because it was so beautiful.
Right. I have a friend who was in Lion King here in New York, and they did a sensory adjusted performance. One of the moms came up to them afterwards. She was crying because her son spoke for the first time during the performance.
Wow.
It made him speak. And he was, I think, 4 years old. He hadn't spoken yet. And he spoke for the first time.
Yeah.
So when I'm having these moments of I'm not contributing anything to the world, I try to remember those.
So it sounds like this argument with yourself, it certainly isn't about your abilities. It's more just about the motivations of why you perform.
Right. And I think it really does creep in when I'm doing longer contracts away from home on the road, where I am in sort of a bubble, that I start to maybe spiral in on myself and start to beat myself up a little bit.
Well, that gets us into story number three. Your father had been sick for a while, but in May of 2019, he has a stroke-like event. And just a few days later, you went off on the road. You went off to do a theater contract. And so I imagine that must have been a very tough time for you to see your father in this condition, but yet you're going off to do work elsewhere. I imagine these existential arguments came back up again.
Oh boy, howdy did they. Yeah, so end of May 2019, my dad had it was sort of like a stroke, and he had been ill for a while. It was June of 2015. He went into the hospital for the first time, and it was sort of a unique thing because my dad, it was in a way his lifestyle choices that caused this. He had abused alcohol for a long time. And it's why my mom and dad got divorced when I was really young. And it was because of that, because of a thing called Korsakoff syndrome, that he went into the hospital for the first time.
What is Korsakoff's?
Sure. So it is, it's not fun. It is when you drink enough alcohol and you don't eat enough. In certain people, you have to have a genetic disposition for it, and you won't know unless these environmental stimuli are met. In certain people, it causes your body to become void of vitamin B. And usually what happens is your brain hemorrhages.
Oof.
So that is what happened to my dad in 2015. And he luckily was outside. And the neighbor saw him because the doctor said that like 90% of people that this happens to, they're inside and it takes them. So he actually recovered from that, but his health was, he didn't recover fully and his health was not great after that. I mean, I feel like I have to take a minute at this point to say, like, I don't want anyone to think that I had a bad relationship with my father because of this. It was complicated because of this, because of his drinking. But I never felt like unsafe or unloved. He was a very loving, good dad. But there was always just this thing, you know? There was, I suppose, a small doubt sometimes in my brain, you know, whether which thing would he choose, me or drinking? And I know for a fact he would choose me, but there was just always that itch, you know, with him. So because of all of that had happened, he never fully recovering. His health was not great for the next 4 years. And then in 2019, he wasn't drinking anymore. But he ended up having this stroke. And I was sitting in a diner with my mom. And it was, I think we were on the way to the airport, and I was thinking about calling and telling them I couldn't come, and she said, you know, what has happened to your dad is a result of his choices in life in some way, in a large way. So you have to put your career and your life first. And I know that my dad would have wanted me to go to do the show anyway. And I was at that point, I mean, he was in the hospital, but I was able to talk to him on the phone, and he loved hearing about my show that I was doing. And then I ended up leaving that contract because I got This Is Us. So I went from Colorado to Los Angeles, and it took us about a month to film that first episode of season 4. So I was out there until like mid-July-ish. And then he passed away August 17th. So I had a month at home with him. Ironically, or coincidentally, the contract that I left would have gone through to the beginning of September.
So you would have missed it.
I would have missed it.
Yeah.
So yeah, he passed away in hospice care. And it was just a stupid infection that ended up going through his whole body and taking him. And
during this time, was there ever a moment, because it can certainly happen when a relative, a loved one is sick or something happens to them, that we wonder, well, what could I have done? What more could I have done? Did those questions ever come up?
Oh God, Patrick, so many times. Yeah, because I'm also his only child. I have siblings through my mom's second marriage. She got remarried when I was 10. And my two brothers are twins, and they're the same age as me. They're 3 months older than me. So we grew up together. These are my siblings. But my dad didn't have any. He didn't get remarried. He didn't have any other children. So everything throughout this whole process was my decision. I remember when he first went in the hospital in 2015 that he was having trouble swallowing. He couldn't swallow. He was aspirating everything. And I was 24 at the time, and the doctors said I had to make the decision whether we were going to put in a feeding tube or not. And I was on my way to rehearsal at Pittsburgh CLO, and I called them to say, go ahead and do the feeding tube. And he just started swallowing again that morning. But then in 2019, again, all the decisions were on me, and it was eventually my decision to stop treatment and do hospice. Cause the doctor said they could get rid of the infection, but it would take incredibly, intense antibiotics, and it would ravage it. I mean, the antibiotics would also really damage his gut, and it would be hard. They'd be really hard on his body. And he said that it would be likely, more than likely, that he would be back there again in another month with another infection, just because of the nature of where his immune system and everything was at that point. And luckily, when I made the decision for him to go into hospice, which at this hospital, they had a really wonderful, lovely hospice care ward in the hospital. So they just transferred him upstairs, and the whole staff was wonderful. But there was an ICU nurse that helped move him up there. And before she went back downstairs, and she had been on his unit the whole time. She knew everything that was going on. And she just gave me this big hug and just said in my ear, "You're 100% making the right decision." Even with that, though, I will still, probably to the the end of my days, think, was that the right decision? Was it the right decision to leave and go to that contract in Colorado? Now knowing that I didn't actually have a whole lot of face-to-face time with him left.
For myself, I grew up without a father of any kind. So it's always interesting to hear other stories of how people experience their fathers, the good, the bad, the ugly, everything in between. And
right,
it's interesting. I wonder the kind of person that I would be had I had this father in my life. And do you wonder sometimes what still you would learn, how much you would grow had your father stuck around more?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I wonder, he wasn't at my wedding. He had already passed. So there are definitely moments that just life events that I wonder what they'd be like if he was there. But I also, you know, my wife's dad had passed before our wedding as well, but he, you know, lived to 89, I think, 87, 89. So I hear about through story, because I never got to meet him, but I hear about the stories that she has with him. And even in the 20 some years that I had with my dad, I have some, definitely some good stories, some good memories that I hold on to, but I just don't have the breadth of stuff that she did and, you know, that she does. I mean, it's funny, even though he also had the same eye disease that I do, I don't really remember us ever talking about it. It never really bothered me, or I didn't even really think about it until now that he's gone. I'm sort of like, how did that never happen? I mean, we might have had it we never like sat down and had a conversation. I feel like maybe when it was happening, if I had like a moment when I was like upset, I feel like I can vaguely remember him sort of like comforting me and like saying, I know this is hard, but like we never really talked about it. And that feels, it's just unfortunate to me, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How would you say that you try your best to carry on his, you know, being your dad's son, carry on whatever legacy he left for you?
Oh, man. Well, my wife and I have been talking about adopting children. Just sort of talking about it. And I'm imagining myself as a father. And some of the positive things that he gave me, like having a meal together each night at the table, there's something really valuable about that I really want to carry on. He had certain ideas of respect that he passed on to me, about respecting yourself and respecting others, that I don't know, especially respecting yourself. I don't know if my dad actually carried that himself, but he definitely instilled that into me. And I hope to carry those things on. And then there are aspects of our relationship that are sort of, you know, I look at them and I think I definitely don't want to do that as a father.
We have to balance it all. Yeah, we learn and.
But I think honestly, if I can carry myself through this world with a sense of dignity and respect for other people, and be someone that people can count on, I think that wherever he is, he would be looking at me and he would be proud.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure he would be. Absolutely. Absolutely. The TV show, This Is Us, I mean, it deals with a lot of these kind of issues as well. So I imagine there's something, some cathartic way of dealing with this in your personal life while also kind of touching on these subject matters in the show as well.
Yeah. Yeah. My storyline never got to have, I never have one of those emotional, devastating moments. They were really, since I existed in the future, they were always trying to portray a very optimistic future. There was a time, there's one scene where I was having a flashback that it ended up being very brief in the final cut, but I was like grilling at this grill at this multi-million dollar crazy mansion in the LA Hills because my character was a rock star. So like I was apparently doing very well. this house was insane, that they were using as a set. And I was grilling outside, and the smoke was supposed to give me this sort of sensory flashback.
I can feel your concern. Blind guy, hot smoker. But I assure you, I have done this hundreds of times, and I still have both my eyebrows. Wait, do I still have both of them?
So far, so good.
And I definitely accessed some things for that. The flashback was supposed to be to a traumatic event, and I definitely accessed some baggage for that one.
You okay?
Yeah. I know it sounds crazy, but every once in a while, that smell hits me and takes me right back to that day.
I know.
Was your father always supportive and one of your biggest fans when it came to your performing career?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, he knew I was going to be on TV too before he passed. He was aware enough that he knew, and he was definitely excited as much as he could be at that time. And yeah, he's very proud of me. I know that.
What would you say that you carry of him, of your time with him? What would you say you carry on to this day?
Oh, well, aside from the fact that we shared the same eye condition, he loved to cook, and I have discovered my love of cooking, especially cooking for other people. And that was something that whenever I spent like half the week with my mom and half the week with my dad. Every night we sat down to a meal together at the table, usually that he had made, but even if it was just pizza, we sat down at the table together and had a meal together. And so when I cook for people, I definitely feel like I'm close to him in that way.
Thank you so much for joining me and Blake Stadnick for this first episode of Season 7. And don't forget, the conversation continues with those audition stories as well as the final 5 questions if you become a Win Me subscriber at whyillnevermakeit.com. Well, I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, in charge of writing, editing, and marketing this podcast, which is a production of Win Me Media. Background music used in this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions and John Bartman. The brief sound clip you heard from This Is Us is produced by NBC Network. Be sure to join me in 2 weeks with Broadway's Sharon Catherine Brown as we talk more about Why I'll Never Make It.